All right, Bernie, thank you very much. Thanks to the organizers. Scott, very pleased to share the podium with you. Very civilized to give out free drinks at an automotive economics seminar. Thank you for that. Not just for the speakers, but I always prefer to speak to an audience that's had a couple of free drinks in them as well.
Would you like some more?
I'll save my next glass for the Q&A, Bernie. I will be speaking tonight in two parts. First, I'll take a little bit to talk about what's happened to the industry in the last couple of years, and Scott has obviously summarized some of the dramatic events. And then I'll talk about what I think is in store for the Canadian industry and the global industry moving forward. And I will be speaking in part from some research that I did for an article that was published for anyone who wants a more fulsome analysis, complete with footnotes and citations, that was published last year in the Cambridge Journal of Regions, Economies, and Spaces. So that's a journal you can get in the library here, and that was 2010. They had a special issue on the auto crisis and what had happened, and I think the whole issue, frankly, is worth reading. My article, indubitably worth reading, especially after a couple of free drinks. So there you go. So, auto manufacturing, of course, a very important manufacturing industry, macroeconomically significant because of its important. Spending on vehicles by consumers accounts for about 10% of total consumer spending. International trade in automotive products, both finished vehicles and parts, accounts for about 10% of world merchandise trade. So that's those are big numbers. From the labor movement lens, as Bernie conveniently advertised me there, I noticed you didn't say that Scott was speaking from a business lens, Bernie, when you introduced him, but...
No, that's fine.
I don't believe in this. I'm no postmodernist, Bernie. Believe me, I know where I stand on this stuff, so that's fine. From a labor lens, auto is important because it's traditionally, for I think both economic and political reasons, been a center of trade union organization and trade union power. In Canada, the auto industry is especially important. Canada, despite all of the problems over the last decade, is still a major automotive producer, a disproportionate automotive producer. Auto accounts for about 15% of our total exports, about 1.5% of our total GDP, but that number's misleadingly small. Its importance to the overall economy is larger by virtue of the very high productivity levels and productivity growth rates in auto, the high incomes that are paid in auto, partly because of the productivity and partly because of the unions, frankly. The importance to exports, if you believe in a balance of payments constraint on economic growth as I do, then the ability to penetrate international markets with successful exports is important. And because of the input-output linkages or the supply chain linkages that tie the auto industry to many other sectors of the economy. The research on those linkages suggests that for every job in a major auto assembly facility directly, there are 7.5 jobs in total that depend on that job. That job itself, and 6.5 others, some of them upstream in the various supply industries, like Scott's company that supply the auto producer, and some of them downstream in the various goods and services industries, consumer spending, even public services that depend on the income and spending of auto workers. So that's why the industry is much more important than just 1.5% of GDP makes it seem. The international geography of global auto production is very interesting and much more complex than you'd think. There isn't a story to be told here about a sort of simple-minded race to the bottom, as you would see in, say, a case of textiles or electronics manufacturing. It's more complicated than that. Again, for both political and economic reasons. Traditionally, there have been three major regions, if you like, where the auto industry has been agglomerated regionally: North America, Europe, and East Asia. And there have been limits, economic and political limits, on the amount of trade in finished products which joins those regions. To the extent that there is a race to the bottom type of mechanism where production migrates in search of lower production costs, it has been experienced within each of those regions, not between them. So within North America, you've seen a southward migration of investment and production towards the southern U.S. and now to Mexico. In Europe, more recently, you've seen a migration towards Eastern Europe with the enlargement of the EU and the low production costs and decent or high productivity numbers that come from Eastern Europe. In Asia, you see a shift towards areas like Thailand. But internationally, there's a lot of automotive trade that occurs between the regions. The biggest flow would be from Eastern Asia to North America. But other than that, the majority of production and sales within each region, basically it's regionalized. What's sold in a region tends to be produced in a region because producers are anxious about transportation costs, about vulnerability to exchange rate fluctuations and other factors. That means that foreign direct investment by global OEMs, globally minded OEMs, has become more important than trade in finished products and linking those regions. Every OEM has to be global in its marketing and production strategies, although they still have a home. Every OEM still has a home and is still rooted in that home. And the FDI inflow has been also uniquely important in North America, where now about half of all vehicle production in North America is undertaken by companies that are not based here, primarily the Japanese and Korean producers, but to a smaller extent the European producers. Another structural change that's had interesting geographical impacts, of course, has been the whole outsourcing of parts production. And the very complicated, very fragile in some ways, network of suppliers and supply chains and just-in-time logistics systems that that link them to the production process. Now, before the financial crisis hit in 2008 in its full effect, there were already major imbalances and I would say strains becoming apparent in that international pattern of geography. And those were also reflected in the financial weakness, the growing financial weakness of the three North American-based OEMs who faced, I think, a uniquely unfavorable environment. Consider the proportion of sales in each of those three regional blocks that I mentioned that's accounted for by companies headquartered within each of those blocks. So think of it as a regional home market share, if you like. In Japan and Korea, in 2005, it was about 93% of sales were accounted for by Japanese and Korean-based OEMs. So it's a very closed market, and they basically carve it up amongst themselves. In Western Europe, it was about 60% of vehicle sales accounted for by European-based OEMs, the rest by either imports or, more importantly, foreign direct investment production by the primarily the Asian and North American automakers. Now, that 60% sounds low. It's a bit misleading because Europe was also a substantial net exporter of vehicles to the rest of the world, or a substantial exporter of vehicles to the rest of the world that helped to offset the vehicles that were imported to Europe from particularly from Asia. So 60%. Then in North America in 2005, the ratio was 55%. So the big three automakers based here accounted for 55% of the sales here. And that number is more weak because there's virtually no vehicles produced in North America exported to the rest of the world. So that sets North America apart from Western Europe. Consider how those numbers had changed by 2008 when the crisis hit. In Japan and Korea, it was still 93%, no change. In Western Europe, the domestic OEM share of the domestic market had actually grown a bit to 63%. And then in North America, it had fallen to 46%. So by that point, the North American producers owned a minority share of the North American market, let alone the challenges that they faced internationally. And that was a very asymmetric situation relative to the financial performance of the European and Asian-based OEMs, who had relatively stable, and in the Asian case, closed home market positions, and who were successful in international exports. Let me talk a bit about the role of labor costs in explaining that international geography and its imbalances. Labor, direct labor anyway, in the auto assembly process is not a major cost. It's only about 7% of the cost of designing, producing, marketing, and selling a vehicle that is accounted for by direct labor by the OEM itself. There's much more spent on capital. There's much more spent on the margins of auto dealers than there is on the people who actually produced the vehicles. Now, that doesn't count, say, in a vertically integrated sense, the labor costs at all of the other stages of production that feed into it, of course. Canada's labor costs, as the crisis hit, were high in the world. Not the highest. Germany had the highest labor costs in the world. But Canada was certainly high, and that was a change from the position we had traditionally filled for some decades before that, a change that was solely due to the appreciation of the Canadian dollar, which appreciated from a low of, you know, the low 60s in 2002 to at par now. That is an increase of over 50% in our relative international cost. Even if you didn't use 62 cents as your base, which you obviously shouldn't, you should use a long-term average or a purchasing power parity variable. Our currency is still 20 to 25% overvalued, and that is very painful. The dispersion of labor costs internationally is important, and as I mentioned, has motivated some migration of investment primarily within each of those three regions. No clear relationship between the success of OEMs and the level of labor costs in their home markets at all. So the Germans, for example, have the highest labor costs, and you could argue by some characteristics, the most successful auto companies. Korea has been the most successful at expanding its share of world production, yet Korean auto costs, labor costs, have been rising far faster than anywhere else in the world. Japan's labor costs are not low. It's hard to measure them because of the bonus system and so on, but they're certainly not low. So immediately you do see a dispersion of labor costs internationally, but it's hard to come up with a univariate correlation, if you like, between labor costs and the success of the OEMs. The financial crisis, which hit in 08 in its full effect, had an enormous impact on the auto industry. That was felt through a terrible chilling of auto sales, partly because of consumer confidence, of course, right? If you read the newspapers in September 2008, the last thing you wanted to do was go and buy a car. More likely, you'd want to go and jump off the bridge. Also, a tightening of credit conditions. Most vehicles, of course, are purchased on credit, and the tightening of credit affected sales. The credit crunch also affected manufacturers, both in the components end of the business and the assembly end of the business, which also undermined the industry. And this was a universal impact. There's nowhere in the world where the auto industry was really protected from the financial crisis. Production in the U.S. declined by over a third in 2009. It declined by about 28% in Canada, 28% in Mexico, 34% in Britain, 60% in Russia, one of the hardest hit countries industrially, 31% in Japan. Declined only 8% in Korea, because they were able to expand their market share in North America and elsewhere to offset some of the losses. The only place the industry was not affected would be not the BRICS, because Russia is part of BRIC, and Russia was affected, but you could say the BICS, I guess, Brazil, India, and China, because of the continued strength in demand conditions there, and the very much, in every one of those cases, sort of homegrown structure of the auto industry. In China, India, and Brazil, most of vehicle sales are produced by, are supplied through production from those countries. Production in those regimes stayed stable. In China, in fact, even as the world experienced financial and economic chaos, auto production grew by 45% in 2009. That is an unbelievable number, and that is when China surpassed the United States to become the largest automotive market in the world. The government response to the challenges of the auto industry during the financial crisis was also universal. There is no auto-producing jurisdiction in the world where government did not ride to the rescue of the industry during the crisis, recognizing the very important financial, macroeconomic, industrial spin-off effects that would have accompanied a dramatic decline or collapse of auto production. So everywhere that autos are produced, governments supplied various forms of support to the auto industry during that terrible year. This consisted generally, I'd say, of three different classes of supports. One was supports for auto sales and sales incentives, often called cash for clunkers or a rebate incentive, sometimes dressed up with a kind of an environmental angle. Trade in your old gas guzzler, buy a new fuel-efficient car, and we'll give you 3,000 euros. That kind of a thing. Those were very important in Europe and Asia, important in America. We didn't do much of that in Canada. I think we were kind of deliberately free-riding in the sense that most vehicles that we produce in Canada are sold in America. So what's the point of offering a sales incentive to Canadian consumers? The second form would have been various types of financial or liquidity support to auto and auto parts producers, sometimes tied to new investment products or capital spending, again, often with a green spin on it. If a company was going to invest in environmentally advanced technology or an environmentally improved production facility, then you could get government financial support for that. Third, in many jurisdictions, the government supplied various kinds of adjustment cushions to assist the workforce and the employment patterns of the industry through the crisis. So in Germany and France, for example, government provided very substantial subsidies for wages or subsidies for work-sharing programs in a proactive effort to prevent auto layoffs in those jurisdictions, to keep the skilled workforce on, if for short hours, and to supplement the income losses that workers experienced as a result. Very interesting contrast there. In Europe, you actually had governments subsidizing auto wages. Okay. In North America, as I'll talk about, it was the exact opposite approach. North America was unique in terms of what governments had to do to support the industry through that restructuring associated with the crisis. It was only in North America that the very future existence of the OEMs was in question as a result of the crisis and the downturn. For sure, the European and Asian companies were experiencing trouble. Toyota experienced its first loss in 52 years, but it was only here that the survival of GM and Chrysler, and to a lesser extent Ford, was actually in question. That caused the governments to not only support the industry, but actually support the company's future existence through the bailout that occurred. And that made the bailout here much more expensive than in other jurisdictions and much more complicated. In Canada, the federal and Ontario governments contributed $14 billion. That's a lot of money to the rescue of GM and Chrysler, and then a few other measures to support the industry. In the United States, the tally was over $80 billion. Now, just for perspective, that's still less money than the governments in both countries spent bailing out the financial industry, which we could say caused the damn crisis in the first place. And the other point to keep in mind is those, by and large, took the forms of loans or other investments in the targeted companies, which means if they do survive, the governments will get their money back, and that is already happening. That is what happened with the last bailout of Chrysler in 1979. The governments got their money back, and I suspect that's going to be the case here as well. The other unique feature of the auto restructuring supports that government advanced in North America was not just this more expensive effort to save the companies, but the fact that the effort featured an explicit attack on automotive trade unions and collective agreements. Nowhere else in the world did that happen. There's nowhere else in the world where government said, as part of saving the auto industry, we're going to force the opening of collective agreements and force different cost savings on the workers there. And I think that reflected a number of things. I think it reflected the generally anti-union political economy of life in North America today, unlike Europe and Asia. It reflected an effort by governments to manage the political risks to them of being seen to bail out unpopular companies. That way they could say, yes, but we're taking some skin off the unions while we're at it. It also reflected the unique presence in North America of a constituency of non-unionized auto assembly plants, those that have been associated with the foreign direct investment here by the Japanese and Korean makers in particular, the European companies secondarily. The fact that non-union auto assembly plants exist here, and that for the most part is not the case anywhere else in the world as well, gave the governments a wedge to go after the compensation of unionized auto workers. The outcome, of course, is I think a familiar story to most in this room, so I won't belabor it. The big three first went to Congress at the end of 2008 pleading for help. They were berated publicly, in part because they flew there on their private jets. Not a smart PR move. Ford then broke from the coalition of the three North American producers and said, I don't like the way this is headed. I think we can profit if we do this on our own. And in that regard, from their private perspective, they were right. Eventually, in the spring of 2009, there was a joint U.S.-Canadian restructuring package to keep GM and Chrysler in business, and that part of that restructuring package was tied to new deals with the bondholders of both companies, who took a humongous haircut, dealers at both companies who faced closures in many cases, and of course new labor contracts with the UAW in America and with the CAW here. The positioning, the sort of framework for those labor contracts was the governments in both countries said that the unionized plants at GM and Chrysler had to match the all-in labor costs at non-union plants of Toyota in each country. So the UAW was instructed to match labor costs at Toyota plants in America. The CAW was instructed to match labor costs at Toyota plants in Canada. That process, in my view, was largely symbolic, motivated mostly by the need to manage the optics on the part of the governments involved. I do not believe that those contract changes had any meaningful impact on the competitiveness of both firms, in part because labor was only 7% of the cost to start with, and in part because of the nature of the changes that were negotiated there were not had no dramatic change on total compensation costs. There was no change in wages. Pensions were actually strengthened through this process, especially at General Motors. The major piece of all-in labor cost savings that resulted from the new contracts was actually a shift in costs associated with the unfunded liability for retiree health benefits. I know that's a mouthful, but for folks who know, GM and the others have long supplied retirement health benefits for people after they retire from the firm, which means they'll continue to pay your dental, your vision, your prescription drug coverage. The problem is there's no fund there. It's not like a pension fund where you actually have a fund to pay people after they retire. This was just a straight pay-as-you-go unfunded system that became a millstone, especially for a company like General Motors, which had five times as many retirees as it had active members. So the structural solution to that was to shift responsibility for this payment to an independent trust fund, which was endowed with, in theory, enough cash up front from the company and indirectly from the government to pay those benefits moving down. That's a change in the responsibility more than it is a reduction in actual costs. The interesting piece of the deal in Canada was, in return for the Canadian government's support for both companies, they were required to accept a commitment to a Canadian manufacturing footprint. That, in other words, the Canadian and Ontario government said, we'll supply you with a proportion of the total costs of the rescue that corresponds to the Canadian share in your total North American operation. So we'll be proportionately part of the solution. But in return for that, down the road, you have to commit to maintaining that proportion of production in Canada. That is a step, a big step, towards the resuscitation of the Auto Pact, frankly. That is saying, you know, we'll be part of making sure these companies exist, but in return for a proportional share of the production and jobs. So that's very interesting, and I think opens up some opportunity for a broader discussion about how we manage the auto industry moving forward. The companies took an accelerated process through Chapter 11 in the US. They did not go bankrupt in Canada. The bottom of that process was June 2009 when, as Scott said, the Chrysler plants were closed entirely and all the other plants were operating at lower speed. Since 2009, production in Canada has now come back about 35% and the in North America, it's come back about 35%. Sales are still weak by historical standards, but they're improving. The companies are either profitable or nearly profitable. In Chrysler's case, they are generating operating profits. You've seen GM issue an IPO, and you see Chrysler moving towards an IPO. So the companies themselves are recovering. That doesn't necessarily mean that the industry is recovering. Of course, we all know that what's good for General Motors is not necessarily good for the country, and that is more true today than ever, especially as GM sees its future in China and the profits, very large profits, it's making from sales in China, serviced from production in China. So what is the stake for Canadians, or American workers for that matter, in that vision for GM's future success? In Canada, we have regained about half of the assembly jobs that were lost during the financial crisis. So that's not insignificant. We're back up to about 40,000 assembly jobs. We have regained very few of the parts jobs that were lost during the crisis. And I think that indicates the greater sensitivity of auto parts production to local cost competitiveness factors, the overvalued dollar, the bankruptcy of many companies, thankfully not including the one in present company that went through the crisis. So looking forward, what is going to happen? I think the industry is recovering nicely in the medium term. I would expect the North American OEMs, including Chrysler, to be recording very sizable profits as vehicle sales continue to increase in the context of capacity that's been dramatically downsized. The recipe for the company's recovery financially is increased sales volume with lower capacity. So you get higher capacity utilization, which drives everything in an industry with high fixed costs like the auto industry does. Also, there's been an improvement in the appeal of the products that the three companies are selling, and dramatically lower debt burdens for GM and for Chrysler. Ford is still a heavily indebted company, and that was the downside to Ford of not going through the restructuring. They've come out with a very high debt load, and even though everything looks rosy for Ford today, I would say structurally they're still kind of fragile. The labor cost changes in the U.S. and in Canada, I would say, were almost irrelevant in the company's recoveries. I think it's been driven by sales and utilization and lower debt far more than by anything else. We will see continuing pressure within the North American regional industry towards migrating towards lower cost locations. And we have seen through the structural crisis of the financial downturn, we've seen Mexico really take off in terms of the critical mass that it has, the supply chain that is located in Mexico, and the negative pressure, in my view, that those factors are going to impact on the industry in the United States and in Canada, all within the context of a continental free trade deal, of course. And these problems are made far worse for us in Canada by the overvalued exchange rate, which is again going to continue to act as a drag on future investment decisions here. I can't believe the arguments that you hear from bank economists and others that the strong Canadian dollar is great for investment here because it makes imported capital equipment cheaper. And then you say, why the hell would you import any of it to Canada when your costs are going to be so much higher than elsewhere because the currency is high? That may make sense in non-tradable industries, I'm not sure. It certainly doesn't make sense in manufacturing. In terms of the environmental challenges facing the auto industry, I'm with Roger, as he said at the beginning. This is an epochal moment of change, and necessarily so. As a human race, we have to wrap our arms around this, and it will require large changes in the technology and nature of the vehicles that we drive. I doubt that we're ever going to stop driving vehicles, frankly. As Scott said, the benefits of having your own car are so appealing to people that they're not going to, you know, yes, by all means, we have to invest in public transit, and by the way, CAW workers make public transit equipment, okay, like subway cars and buses and so on, so we're all for that, but there's still going to be an immense appeal to driving your own vehicle, but the nature of that vehicle is going to have to change dramatically, and that could be a positive for the industry, frankly. Here's a simplistic example. A hybrid vehicle has two engines in it, not one, an electric engine and a gasoline engine. That means you had to hire the workers to produce two engines, not one. It means the vehicles are more expensive, absolutely, and it means there'll be big investments in new technology, which could be good, but in and of itself, I don't view that as a negative. I view the inevitable move to reduce the environmental footprint of the auto industry as potentially positive, but only if we manage it. There's absolutely no guarantee that greening the auto industry will mean we get to protect our jobs. You know, there's a knee-jerk assumption out there that the reason GM and Chrysler were in trouble is because they weren't producing green cars, and we'd all be better off if they had been, and then we'd be safe. That is absolute nonsense. Absolute nonsense. All of the companies, including Toyota, are in it to make money for their shareholders, not to preserve the planet. And all of the companies will locate their investment and production decisions according to what maximizes the return to their shareholders. Give you an example, the first ever hybrid vehicle manufactured in Canada was a hybrid pickup truck manufactured by GM in Oshawa for a grand total of 8 months. And then GM closed the plant and moved it to Mexico. Okay, so greening the industry in and of itself will protect nothing unless you're challenging the rules of globalization at the same time. And that's where I would conclude looking forward in terms of the challenges facing the labor movement and I'd say the broader progressive movement from the experience in the auto industry of the last couple of years. I do believe that automotive manufacturing is a strategic industry for the reasons I mentioned at the beginning, because of the spin-off benefits to the rest of the economy, the technology, the innovation, the productivity that's embedded in this industry. I believe that there's a policy imperative for governments to intervene to protect our fair share of that strategic industry. And it should be a long-run policy goal that Canada produces at least as many automotive products as we consume here. That's a way of getting our fair share of an industry that has very broad external benefits to the whole economy and to all of society. And there's various creative ways that that could be done. The Auto Pact was the old way that that was done. There's new ways that it could be done with the same principle, such as leveraging the government government's, the Canadian government's equity stake in GM and Chrysler, and expanding that, as Volkswagen does, by the way. Volkswagen has public equity investment by the state in Germany, where it's headquartered. Renault has public equity investment from the French government. Hyundai and Kia have public equity investment from the Korean government through the Korean Development Bank, and so on. Why don't we do the same thing? I know that sounds like a revolutionary idea in today's neoliberal context, but I think it would be a very clever and incremental way to leverage our investments in this industry and make sure that we get shares of it down the road. Other things that could be done: there's this initiative that Scott's firm and our union and others are part of called the Canadian Automotive Partnership Council. Don Walker is the chair of that. This is supposed to map out a kind of industrial policy framework to protect our share of this industry. It won't happen with incremental shifts in efficiency and, you know, building new infrastructure and so on. I think it will take a bigger vision in terms of how we protect our share of this industry. And I think it will mean challenging the rules of the game in globalization, which, by the way, is what the Chinese have done. It's not an accident. They have 15 million vehicles a year of sales and 15 million vehicles a year of production. That's a deliberate goal of government policy. Build here to sell here. And other countries use various tools similar to that. Why don't we take off our Boy Scout uniform that we wear in trade negotiations and start to do the same? That would involve a bigger political shift, of course, but I remain eternally optimistic on that score, particularly at seminars that serve free drinks before the presentation. So, thank you very much for your attention. I look forward to the discussion.